It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll hear about a radio remake of the holiday classic It's a Wonderful Life coming up in Green Bay.
First, according to a consultant's report out this week, Wisconsin could save $42 million by moving away from the current model of health insurance for state workers and moving to what's called a self-insurance system.
It's an idea that's been considered by state legislators in recent years, though previous consultant reports have been mixed on the cost savings. So what's different this time around, and will we see the state move in this direction?
Here with us now to talk more about the report and how self-insurance might work in Wisconsin is David Wahlberg. He's a health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. David, welcome back to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
So what does it mean? Other states do this, as I understand it. What does it mean for a state to self-insure health coverage for employees?
So there's basically two ways employers can provide health insurance for their workers. One is fully insured, and the other one is self-insured. So with fully insured, which is generally used by small or middle-sized employers, they hire a insurance company to cover the risk for health care claims. So the premiums from workers and the employer go to the insurance company. And then if somebody has, say, a need for a heart transplant, a really expensive kind of care, maybe unexpectedly, the insurance company has to manage the risk for that. With self-insurance, which is typically used by larger employers, the company or the employer basically collects the premiums and keeps them themselves in sort of a cash reserve, and then they have to be have the risk for paying out those large unexpected claims.
In a nutshell, then, the change on the table would move us from that first thing you said to that second thing you said. Do I have that right?
Correct. Yes.
And so this report, this newest report, and this differs from some earlier reports, says the state could save $42 million a year by making the switch. So where do those savings come from?
Well, yeah, and just to give a little background, like you already mentioned, there's been some previous reports, a couple of reports in 2012 and 13, and they said the state could save anywhere from $20 million to having to incur a cost of up to $100 million. So it was kind of a mixed picture. This new report is from a consultant called Siegel, and they said the state could save $42 million a year. The main savings would be $18 million from an Affordable Care Act fee, and then also $11 million from lower administrative costs, and $11 million also from eliminating the profit margins of the insurers that they currently use.
So what steps would be involved in moving the state to that new model, that self-insurance model?
Yeah, it could take a variety of steps or turn out in a variety of ways. But so currently there are 18 plans that state workers choose among around the state. Actually, one of those is a self-insured plan. This gets a little confusing, but about less than 5% of state workers now are in a self-insured plan. But the vast majority, more than 95%, choose among 17 fully insured plans around the state. So if the state wanted to switch to mostly or all self-insurance, one idea would be that they would contract with one insurance company, which could be from within the state or out of the state, to administer the whole program, or potentially they could use a few companies, including some of those that are currently involved.
Talking to David Wahlberg from the Wisconsin State Journal about a possible move in Wisconsin to what's called a self-insurance system providing health care to state workers. David, good time for me to disclose that I am a state worker, have a possible economic impact from this. As I ask this next question, how could this change, if people are talking about this yet, affect state workers, the health care options they have, what they might pay for it?
Yeah, well, the first part of that, the options could be fewer. Instead of having a variety of choices in each county, for example, there might just be one or two plans to choose from. In terms of the benefits and the cost, it's a lot harder to say. One reason the state might want to do self-insurance is that they would have more control over the benefit design. And so what they would do with that control is kind of hard to predict, but potentially they could try to find other savings that way. So perhaps that would involve more costs for workers, you know, co-pays and so forth for insurance, but that doesn't necessarily have to be the result of self-insurance.
Let's get into some of the politics and procedure here. Who would the decider be when it comes to making this switch?
Right. So as you know, the state worker health plan covers a little over 200,000 state workers and then another 40,000 or so local workers, and both of those figures include their family members and children and so forth. And the program is run through the Department of Employee Trust Fund, and there is a board called the Group Insurance Board. It's an 11-member board, mostly controlled by the governor through administrators or appointees. And so basically that board is the one that makes the decisions. There is a bill, though, active in the legislature, just approved by the Assembly, that would give the Joint Finance Committee some say over a self-insurance contract.
And did I read you right? The governor, there's thought that the governor might veto something like that, or veto any effort by the legislature to have control over those appointees?
Yeah, so there was some language in the budget earlier this year that would have given the legislature more say in who is on this board, and actually it would have expanded the board with legislative appointed members. But the governor vetoed those provisions in the budget back in July. That appears to have led to a bill that the Joint Finance Committee, the budget writing committee of the legislature, introduced just a month or two ago, wanting more control over this process. When the initial bill came out, the governor said right away that he would veto that bill as well, but the bill has been sort of narrowed down to just focusing on approving a self-insurance contract. So apparently the governor is now saying that he would likely approve that.
There has been some criticism of this from the Wisconsin Association of Health Plans and some lawmakers. What kind of concerns have you seen raised, David?
Yeah, well, Wisconsin is a little different than most states in that we have a lot of health insurance plans and we have these sort of regional healthcare systems, you know, in Madison and Milwaukee and Fox Valley and Eau Claire and La Crosse. And each of those areas has these provider-owned healthcare systems. And so it's sort of an essential part of the way we have healthcare in our state. And the health plans are owned by the providers. And there's more competition among those plans than in essentially any other state. So the health insurers say that the state worker plan changed. The state worker plan represents about 14% of the market. So if you sort of take that out of this competitive market, it could have a big impact on healthcare systems around the state. They say it could reduce access and sort of disrupt the current healthcare market.
And as we wrap up, David, what is the next step?
So this group insurance board is scheduled to meet in February and likely will take up some parts of this in February, though it's pretty unlikely that they would do a sort of full up or down on self-insurance at that point. They may take on some other aspects of it that could eventually lead to self-insurance, but more likely in another year.
David, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Okay, sure. Thank you.
That's David Wahlberg with the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about a report out this week saying that Wisconsin could save over $40 million by moving to a self-insurance system for state employees.
Hey! Merry Christmas, Mr. Potter!
Happy New Year!
here to you in jail. Go on home. They're waiting for you.
This Thursday and Friday, the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay will present the beloved holiday classic. Just heard a bit of the movie version there. It's a Wonderful Life, but this play will have a bit of a twist.
This version reimagines the story as a live radio play. Laura Riddle joins us now. She's the director of the play and a professor of theater at UW-Green Bay. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Laura, what made you decide to turn this holiday classic film into a radio play?
I did not do it myself. This was turned into a radio play by Joe Landry, and he did it after trying to actually recreate the film on stage, and when they realized that it was getting incredibly big and expensive, they came up with the concept of creating it as a live radio play, because in 1947, after the film had opened, there was actually a one-hour radio drama version starring Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed of the play with live sound effects, the way that they were done back then with a Foley table. And so Joe Landry wrote this script, and since about 2004, it has just blown up and become really well known throughout the country. There's a production in Chicago every year. Many cities have productions every year. So the script that we have is written as a group of people in 1946 in a radio stage in front of a live audience. And the one-hour play is performed live. We've added pre-show music from the 40s, and that's also live. And the story is told with voices and sound effects and music.
So what are some of the challenges of doing a radio drama that might be different from a typical stage play?
Well, this one took me by surprise. I've done a lot of directing, and I was not fully prepared for what rehearsing a radio play would be. I'm a real fan of old-time radio and listen to it every week. And so I thought I had a pretty good clue. But then when we started rehearsing, the specificity of combining music, sound effects, and words, the timing of it, to be able to do it live without editing every night has required a very different kind of rehearsal than what I'm used to. And for the first time, I'm using the Foley table, and those are the live sound effects that are made that create sounds that are indicated in the script. They give the play so much more as far as a feeling of what's happening to the audience at home listening, but our stage, our theater audience gets to watch these sound effects being made.
Right. Yes. Let's hear about that Foley table. What kinds of things are you using to make your sounds?
Well, it's all kinds of things. And I'm working very closely with Paul Heim, who is the technical director at the Widener Center. He and I have done several plays together. He's worked with me as a sound designer, and he loves old-time radio as much as I do, and toured with Five by Design Radio Days. And he has been fabulous in finding effects that only would have been available in 1946. Mm. And so, for example, the sound of a car door shutting, we don't want a real car door on stage, but he found a vintage ice chest that was metal, and slamming the lid on it sounds like a car door. So that is one of the many things that's on top of and around the Foley table. We also have to create the sound of ice cracking and the splashing of Clarence going into the water. And I was actually I laughed when I was listening to your last segment, because it began, the sound of ice cracking signals the arrival of deer. And that's one of my favorite sound effects in the show, is the sound of ice cracking. We tried a number of different approaches to it, And what I'd like to do now, if I can, is do a live demonstration
sure.
of ice cracking. So this is what it sounds like. That's our ice cracking.
Okay.
Yeah, what is that? I have no idea.
No idea?
Should I know?
Frying bacon. No.
Bubble wrap.
It's three stalks of celery being twisted.
Oh, great.
And I think that I love most of all when the sound effects are not the real thing. You know, a bell is a bell, but we had to have a very specific bell. But that one, and obviously people falling into the water, glass breaking on stage. We worked with so many different sounds when they throw the rocks through the windows. And we ended up, our Foley area has cooked sugar glass. And it's the same glass that would be used in a breakaway bottle for a film or theater production. So it's perfectly safe. We don't have to worry about shards. Mm. But it still looks like glass, and it breaks like it and sounds like it.
How are the actors taking to this, you know, this radio-focused script here?
It's totally new for them. Most of them knew nothing about old-time radio. And we spent a few days at the beginning of the process listening, and I was so excited that they were enthusiastic about listening to the mystery and hearing the commercials. And I played them some old comedy pieces, and they just laughed at the corny old jokes. And so I was really glad that they were able to embrace it. It's been a real challenge for them. They're working on communicating with their voice everything that's going on, but the reality is they're in front of people at the Widener Center who are watching the show.
Well, so, Laura, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it
you're
today.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking to Laura Riddle, professor of theater at UW-Green Bay and the director of UW-Green Bay's It's a Wonderful Life radio play.
And we'll have some information up on the Central Time Facebook page, a link to more info about the production. The world was already struggling to absorb the waves of Syrian refugees fleeing into Europe and other nations because of violence at home.
But in light of the terrorist attacks that rocked Paris on Friday, politicians and citizens around the world are debating whether it's safe to accept refugees. The fear is that terrorists will take the opportunity to infiltrate countries and carry out more attacks. More than half of the governors in the United States, including Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, have said that they are not open to accepting Syrian refugees.
Our next guest says taking in refugees is not a threat to our national security, and it could even make us safer in the long run. Joining us now is David Mendikoff. He's a director of Middle Eastern Studies and a professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. David, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, you're very welcome.
Before we get into the heart of your argument, I want to talk about the refugees coming from Syria and who they are. I understand you've spent some time in a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan, I think it was. What kind of stories were you hearing there?
The stories that I heard when I was in the Zaatari camp in Jordan were of very bright people, young people often from, you know, whose parents had professional background, who have lost really everything and who are really ambitious and, you know, want to sort of contribute to society. I mean, I think that one of the tragedies of all this is that there's so much human capital, you know, people who really are just like young folks everywhere who are, you know, eager to kind of complete education and make a difference. I was very impressed, for example, by the type of vocational programs that that camp officials were offering, and you know how much people who were there in the camps were trying to take advantage of them.
Well, since those attacks in Paris, beforehand, yeah, but more so since then, there's been an idea that if we, the United States, take in more refugees than we have already from Syria in particular, we're running a big risk that ISIS members, other terrorist groups could infiltrate, could pose as refugees, find their way here to the United States and do damage. How big a risk do you see that as?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I want to stress from the outset that I teach at a large public university. I have many students who serve in the military, and I very much understand you know, why we get scared about these kinds of things. But, you know, at the end of the day, fear isn't the same thing as facts and data. And refugees, generally speaking, I mean, we know this from the American experience, are not violent terrorists. I mean, there are, you know, since 9/11, there have not been any real incidents of refugees that we've admitted, including from the Middle East, you know, being involved in terrorist activities. And the reason for that is sort of simple. It's not that easy for people to come to the Middle East to get here in the first place. And, you know, they go through the rigorous security that we've established. But then if they want to become refugees, they have to go through a much higher level of scrutiny. And they normally can't get to the United States until they've done that, you know, in an American embassy. So the fact of the matter is we have very secure procedures, you know, outside of our country through which we process refugees. And, you know, they're really, I mean, these are people who are fleeing ISIS, who are fleeing tyranny, and who, you know, again, it's quite demonstrable once you look into refugee websites and numbers, tend to be people who are, you know, often professionals and whose lives have been disrupted. So, you know, on the one hand, betting on people who are welcome to our country, you know, with our ideals and values, when they and their families are vulnerable, betting on those people being grateful for the opportunities that we can give them, and, you know, sort of like other refugees have done, like, you know, Albert Einstein or Steve Jobs, is, you know, who is a child of Syrian refugees. Betting on those people to be grateful to the United States and make contributions is better. It makes much more sense than fearing them. And indeed, I mean, this idea that somehow you can kind of close the world off, let, you know, 4.5 million people who are in dire threat of their lives just kind of starve through a cold winter, turn a blind eye, and then hope that somehow then that's not going to come back in some way to haunt us, that's the real risk.
A lot of the argument has been people in favor of bringing in refugees say there's a moral obligation. Critics say there's a national security risk. You're flipping this on its head in a recent piece you wrote saying, no, taking them in enhances our national security, short and long run. Can you spell out the broad strokes of that argument?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely the case. You know, first of all, what we know is that people who are likely, whether, you know, this is sort of white supremacists in the United States or Middle Easterners in Daesh, people who are likely to kind of commit violent acts tend to feel that they don't have any options in their lives and, you know, that they basically have very little to lose. The refugees in Syria now, you know, are in very bad situation. And so leaving them there is exactly the kind of thing, you know, that radicalizes them. I mean, what we know about ISIS is that it was created during the breakdown of the Iraqi state. And, you know, again, however well-meaning the U.S. was in Iraq, the disorder that was left is exactly what bred this sort of terrorist state. So we know, first of all, that when you do nothing about this kind of thing, you know, when there is disorder, when people feel like they don't have normal lives, that's when they're likely to be susceptible, you know, a small number of them, to violent acts. Secondly, you know, what I just mentioned, you know, we know that when we welcome people with our American values, we're very good at integrating people into society, and what we do is we create contributors. You know, I mean, refugees from the Nazi system during World War II were responsible for amazing scientific and technical advances, not just Albert Einstein. I mean, we know that these people are, you know, frontline contributors to our society, and that includes people with direct experience of what ISIS, you know, stands for, who can serve as examples and witnesses of, you know, how bad these guys are. The way that the few Americans that are drawn into ISIS's net get drawn in is through remote social media recruitment, you know, heavy recruitment when these Americans are vulnerable. And what we need is to have people here, you know, who have experienced the reality of life under ISIS, who can say, this is not what things are like, you know, and who better than people who have suffered and are looking to contribute to society to be able to sort of make those statements and arguments? Already, there are a lot of Syrian Americans, you know, who have been very important to trying to kind of take stands against the Islamic State, take stands against dictatorship in Syria, and we have every reason. There's no reason to doubt that if, you know, you give somebody a helping hand when they feel vulnerable and you show them what your values are, those people respond. And, you know, more, they become allies in the fight to sort of end the kind of chaos and violence that we really, you know, have to think of as a long-term kind of problem that we can't just shut out and ignore.
Talking to David Mednikoff from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, in a recent piece he wrote saying taking in Syrian refugees in the long term boosts our national security. Not so a risk, but it will enhance our national security. Talk a little more, David, about this idea of, you know, the people who have experienced ISIS and the Assad regime, for that matter, at firsthand, helping de-radicalize maybe people who could be radicalized in the United States or other Western nations. It sounds like you're saying, don't just bring them in, put them on the lecture circuit, get them out on social media.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, I mean, whenever, with all immigrants, everybody has their talents and strengths. And, you know, we have immigrants from Syria like Kali Khoury, you know, again, her parents, who's a, you know, prominent television show and movie director that, I mean, we know from Thelma and Louise in Nashville. I mean, people have different talents. But again, the bottom line here is we're looking at a human security nightmare. We, you know, the United States is a globalized country. We cannot just sort of put up some sort of force field and expect that somehow all the disorder in the world is not going to reach us. What really makes sense is that people, you know, who have direct experiences with the real tragedy that's happened in the Middle East, you know, can come and help us understand better what these sorts of tragedies are. I mean, I want to stress that also that, you know, France is not the United States, and I don't want to make too many parallels, but most, you know, there's a lot of people been talking about how one of the attackers may have been somebody who came from a false, you know, with a false Syrian passport. And right now, as I understand it, you know, there's no conclusive evidence. But what we know is seven out of the attackers were French. They were homegrown. And, I mean, the issues around sort of homegrown violence, I mean, it's exactly why you need people who have actually experienced and suffered and can appreciate what the reality is, you know, to sort of head that off. And that, I mean, there is just nothing like the people that I've met in these camps who, you know, are just normal people. I mean, just by accident, they've been in a very unfortunate situation. They are looking at this moment for basic security and basic opportunities to contribute to society and to give back to societies. And, you know, this is the moment where if we say no, you know, we accept some people from other countries, but not people from Syria and not Muslims, we're sending the exact message that the Islamic State has said in their printed materials, you know, they're after. I mean, their goal is to sort of make people feel like there's a choice in the world between Westerners who don't care about Muslims and, you know, the Muslims that they claim to represent. That is a false choice. And, you know, the only way to sort of break that is to have liberal values. I mean, I don't mean liberal, you know, political, but I mean open-minded discussion and the kind of welcoming and melting pot integration that the United States, you know, has stood for hundreds of years.
David Mednikoff is with us. He's director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's making the case that turning away Syrian refugees would make the world and individual countries less safe.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you feel that, either for moral reasons or to protect national security, that the U.S. should accept Syrian refugees? Do you agree with Governor Walker that Syrian refugees should not be relocated to Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234 with your comments or post on the Central Time Facebook page. That's 800-642-1234.
We continue our conversation now with David Mednikoff about why he thinks that accepting Syrian refugees in the U.S. and other Western countries ultimately makes us more safe, boosts our national security, doesn't hurt it. He's director of Middle Eastern Studies and professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Is the Syrian refugee crisis an American concern? Would you support accepting Syrian refugees in the U.S.? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments, or send us an email to talk@WPR.org.
We'll go to our callers now. Jerry is on the line in Waukesha. Jerry, hi.
Hi there.
What do you think?
I think the gentleman from the university needs to redo his studies, because quite frankly, anybody coming into this country will tell anybody what they want to hear to make it through the vetting system. You're not going to get inside their head to find out their true beliefs. He just said that the people from Paris were homegrown. What did they have to be disturbed about other than their Muslim radical Islamic beliefs?
Jerry,
they lived in Paris. And they live for what may be a normal life, not the refugees from Syria. So if those guys got problems, the other people have more problems.
Jerry, thanks for the call. So a couple of points there, David. Jerry's skeptical about the vetting system for refugees.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, I mean, let me say a couple things about the refugee system. And first of all, we haven't really talked about the legalities, but, you know, obviously the United States has, like most civilized countries, taken on an obligation to take in as many people as they can who have a well-founded fear of persecution in the countries they come from. That's the legal definition of refugees. And again, you know, I think that I understand the caller's concerns, but, you know, I think that it's this lumping together thing that's really problematic. I mean, it doesn't really make sense to lump people who have been persecuted by ISIS together, you know, with people who are adherents of it. I understand, you know, the point about you can never be sure about the vetting process, and this is true for any type of refugees. But, you know, the bottom line is our borders have been, you know, with an existing system that's let in Iraqi refugees. We have not had a lot of incidents, you know, for better or for worse. Refugees from Arab countries are subject to many more sort of security checks. People's whereabouts can be ascertained. It isn't just listening to their stories. You know, again, for better or for worse, we have a lot of sort of coercive apparatuses around. And again, I mean, I think that the alternative, the sort of, okay, let's just ignore it and turn our back, is you almost guarantee that, you know, people are stuck in a situation where they're starving and dying, and they know that the United States turned their back in their hour of need. I mean, that is how you radicalize people, not by saying, you know, you should come in. And the risk of sort of one or two people out of, you know, 10,000 who we might make the wrong judgment of is much less of a risk than, you know, 4.5 million looking at our country, seeing what our values are supposed to be, and hearing that because they're Muslim, we're not going to let them in. I mean, that's where, you know, ISIS gets them.
Jerry, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Joy in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Hi. Thanks a lot for this program. I belong to a small peace group, and we are all discussing this, that we need to take in more refugees. Our country would spend a lot less money, spend a lot less lives, and a lot less effort if we would be making friends around the world. I just don't hear any kind of leadership talking about the strategies of peace. Our country, I guess, has benefited by stirring up trouble in the Middle East. We get more control of oil supplies, but then again, you know, violence begets violence. Exclusion begets exclusion. What if somebody comes to our country and does more terrorism? Where will we be able to be accepted as refugees?
Joy, thanks for the call. So, in effect, apart from the moral argument, she's saying this taking in refugees can buy goodwill around the world.
Yeah, thanks, Joy, for that. And, you know, I want to add to this point, that because I know that this is very hard. You know, somebody like me, I mean, I'm not trying to stand here as a know-it-all expert who understands, you know, everything about security. But what I've experienced as, you know, an Arab politics and law specialist is a lot of interaction with people in the region, Muslims, non-Muslims, people from different countries. And, you know, whenever you get to know people and varied people, you see how different they are, how varied their perspectives are. And, you know, it becomes, I mean, Islam is not some monolith. You know, Muslims become just plain old people like everybody else. And, you know, it's that sort of experience that I've been very lucky to have that most people don't have. But that when you actually, you know, get to know Muslims, when you actually get to know immigrants from Arab countries, you know, you realize that it's just a mix of people. And, you know, whether you want to think of this as peace building or terrorism deterrence, you know, it's in these kinds of encounters, this sort of, you know, opening that happens when people live alongside one another, or like in my case, where you travel, you know, where you, and when you, I mean, that you can actually break through this. I mean, and my many years of experience in the Middle East, you know, I think gives me the sort of personal sorts of experiences where I know what's dangerous, I know what's not, just like you, anywhere you would know. And, you know, this particular population who are so vulnerable and are often, you know, children and women, it's not the most dangerous population in the world in terms of the kind of things we fear.
Talking to David Mednikoff from the University of Massachusetts Amherst about refugees and national security. One more caller, Tim, is with us in West Salem. Tim, hi.
I'm actually stunned. I just can't believe what I'm hearing. The guy that your guest is saying, you know, he's a professional of Middle East studies, and yet he knows that other countries in the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia, they are taking none, zero of these refugees, and they're a very wealthy, rich country. And the reason why they've come out and they've said, we are not going to accept these refugees because of a terrorism risk. But even take that aside, if it wasn't even a terrorist risk, you're saying that the goodwill, if we deny them, we're going to cause more problems. What about these other countries in the Middle East? Are they causing more problems?
Yeah. Tim, thanks for the call, David.
That's a great question. Thank you. I mean, I should tell you that most of the work that I do, most of my research is in Gulf countries, so I know these societies really well. And that is really, you know, a well-placed question. Now, there's one thing I do want to say about this that's kind of something of a, I mean, it doesn't get at your big point, which I'll get at in a sec. But, I mean, it's one thing that's true is that the Gulf countries have not formally recognized refugee status, and that has to do with sort of their own politics around citizenship. And I mean, the reality is, in fact, Gulf countries do take in a lot of Syrians. They just don't call them refugees. So, you know, again, not to negate the underlying point you're making, there are, in fact, people that we might think of as refugees in Gulf countries. That's sort of a, you know, misconception because of the way the term refugee is defined. But, you know, what you're saying is, shouldn't Arab Gulf countries be doing more? You know, they have a lot of money. And I agree with you. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. They do give a lot of money. You know, most of the housing that I saw in the Zaatari refugee camp was provided by Gulf countries. But I agree with you that they should be doing more. And indeed, I mean, one of the things that I really advocate for is that this is a global problem. And a lot of the responsibility for the problem, you know, is Middle Eastern countries. Countries need to get together at a national level and really sort of coordinate responses. I mean, this should not be a problem that is just on the United States, just on European countries. You know, Arab countries really do need to sort of step up and try to do more in conjunction, you know, with our countries. But really, you know, all I can advocate for, because I'm very concerned about our society in the long run, is that we don't make some sort of posturing that says, you know, we hate Muslims, we don't trust people fleeing repressive governments. I mean, you know, we are a democracy that should be really open to, you know, to people that have been persecuted by a dictator, or, you know, even worse, by, you know, this awful Islamic State. And by all means, you know, these other countries ought to step up and coordinate with us so that, you know, we can do our share and they can do their share too.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome, and thanks for having me.
That was David Mednikov. He's Director of Middle Eastern Studies and Professor of Public Policy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. You can keep sharing your thoughts on this conversation, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page.